Monday morning to you. You're listening to Mountain Money here on KPCW. I'm Renee Bodley-Miller here with my co-host Doug Wells. Hi, Doug.
Good morning.
It looks like it's snow out there. April 30th. First day of May is tomorrow. If April showers bring May flowers, what does April snow bring, I wonder?
That's a good question. But, you know, I'm grateful for the fact it was such a beautiful weekend. I'll take a rainy, snowy Monday anytime over having it over the weekend.
Yeah, and a great Saturday in exchange for that. We didn't normally do weather at the top of the show, but I just wanted to tell our listeners, since it is a little unusual out there, we've got 100% chance of snow. We can look outside and see that. High of 44 degrees today, and the forecast from the National Weather Service for the 84060 zip code says snow before 1 o'clock, then snow showers likely after 1 o'clock, and total daytime snow accumulation 1 to 2 inches possible, snow showers likely tonight, mixing with rain after 7 o'clock, then gradually ending. And then tomorrow, Doug, partly sunny. High of 51. So
all
the
right,
sun's
nice.
Going to come back.
Earlier this week, it was calling for it to be wet for the next 3 or 4 days, but it looks like that's changing. So maybe just one day, and then we're back to sunny weather here in Park City.
We've got a great lineup this morning for our show. This weekend, on Friday, about 800 people gathered in Salt Lake for the Utah Economic Summit, and one of the speakers there is Natalie Gochner. She's the Associate Dean in the David Eccles School of Business and Director of the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah. She also serves as the Chief Economist for the Salt Lake Chamber. If you want to talk to someone about Utah's economy, my experience is Natalie Gochner is the woman to go to. She's going to be a lot of fun to talk to this morning.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we're going to continue on the theme of economics and what's happening in the state of Utah. We have Mark Nold, who's the supervising economist and lead researcher on a recent study on Utah's information technology industry. We talk a lot about that here on the show. They're high-wage jobs. They're good jobs, and we're going to find out where those jobs are coming from and what types of people are getting those jobs, what kind of education folks need. It's a pretty comprehensive study on information technology here in Utah. And then our last guest is going to be Liz Garcia-Levitt. May is Mental Health Month. And Liz is a clinical social worker and health educator at the University of Utah. And she's going to talk to us about some of the mental challenges as folks transition from work to retirement, kind of as we all age, from work to retirement, then also as we transition from independent living to managed care. Unfortunately, losing a spouse and how we deal with that from a mental standpoint. So it's going to be a good conversation and kind of kicking off the station's focus on mental health this month. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Whitney Ryan from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
This is Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender for Mountain West Bank, sponsor of the amazing programming on KPCW. At Mountain West Bank, we offer consumer loan options as well as home loans and business loans in one location. Mountain West Bank, just off Kearns, next to the theaters. MountainWestBank.com, division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
The time is 9:10. This is Renee Bodley-Miller and my co-host Doug Wells from Mountain Money. We have a real treat for our listeners this morning. Natalie Gochner is a Utah economist who has a great talent for taking wonky public policy speak and turning it into everyday language the rest of us can understand. She joins us on the phone this morning. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning, Renee. You're kind. Thank you.
Well, we brought you on the show this morning because of the Utah Economic Summit on Friday. About 800 people were there. And from what I understand, the message was Utah's economy is still growing, but maybe we're seeing the brakes a little bit.
Well, it's an extraordinary time for the Utah economy, in large part because of the length of the expansion that we're in. The state is well on its way to its second longest expansion in modern history. We're in our eighth year of a growing economy. It's a prosperous time. The federal tax cuts have pretty much ensured that that will continue in 2018. So we celebrated those, that good news, but there's certainly a lot of things on the horizon, and most importantly, I'd point to rising costs as and a labor shortage as the two things that will moderate our growth.
And we are looking at the Feds possibly this week raising interest rates again. What do you think will happen, and how would that affect our economy?
Yeah, when I say rising costs, that's one of them I mean. And so you have housing prices increasing, mortgage rates going up, you have wages rising, and as interest rates rise, it will definitely pinch down on the economy. It will intentionally try to quell some of the inflationary effects that can happen during prosperous times. And so that's one of a few reasons why I think the forecast for 2019 is a more moderate forecast.
So, Natalie, a lot of the growth that we've seen over the last 8 years, we have forward-thinking people in the state from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, to thank for the growth that we're seeing today. What do you think are the initiatives that we're doing today that set us up for growth 5 years from now, 7 years from now?
Doug, I love your point because I preach that. In other words, I think a lot of the good outcomes that we're having right now have come because, someone decided to double the number of engineers and scientists graduating from our universities, and that decision was made in 2001, and it takes a while for that to happen, and now we, reap the benefits. I would think that the Olympics were the same thing, that we benefit from the Olympics more in the out years than in the first couple of years after the Games. So right now, I think the two big ones that loom large, and they were in my presentation on Friday, but the inland port and the significant amount of effort that's going into the point of the mountain and the prison relocation. And I'm happy to talk about those in more detail, but those are the two big ones.
Yes, let's hit the inland port, Natalie. Can you explain to our listeners what that is and how that will affect job growth here?
Yeah, sure. Well, so if you think about Utah, we're in the center of the interior western United States, and that puts us, roughly halfway between the Continental Divide and the Pacific Ocean and between the Canadian border and the Mexican border. And so we're right there in the crossroads. And because of that location, and then because of a lot of things that have happened, whether it be the new expansion of our incredible Salt Lake City International Airport, or the fact that I-15 and I-80 and I-70 and I-84 all come into our state, and also the incredible Union Pacific Rail Network. If you look at a map of, rail connectivity in the western United States, Salt Lake City is at the center of it. There is no city in the interior western United States with better rail connectivity than Utah. So the idea of an inland port basically recognizes that the Pacific Coast ports are crowded and expensive, and that there is some reason why you can bring those container ships to the, the ports, but do all of the customs processing and unloading and, redistributing from Salt Lake City rather than the, SeaTac or Long Beach or wherever you want to, think of in the West Coast. So the inland port, just brings those containers to Salt Lake City, someplace west of the airport, where you can reprocess and redistribute and connect to that global supply chain.
So, Natalie, outside of the land where the inland port is going to be based, there's still a fair amount of controversy over whether or not it makes sense for Utah to invest in an inland port. What's the other side of the argument? What are the people that are against it saying? Why do they not see this economic opportunity?
Right. Well, I think most of the controversy has been more about who gets to decide, who controls the land use, who makes those decisions. And there's been a significant amount of tension between the state legislature and Salt Lake City on this point. And I think it's unfortunate because I do think that they share common goals. An inland port is a very large endeavor, larger than Salt Lake City. It involves the entire state, multiple counties, the whole metropolitan area. So there is a significant state interest. But I think most of the controversy has been over the way that the legislature, and I'm going to use a strong word, but swooped in and took some land use powers away from Salt Lake City. And, of course, this is still in play, Doug, because, the governor signed a bill saying that there were flaws in the bill and that he would convene a special session to fix them. I remember the Salt Lake Tribune then editorialized that the minute the governor signed the bill, he owns this issue, and so he needs to help get the proper settlement. And so this is still playing out live fire for us, but it doesn't, in my mind, take away from the notion that investing in the global supply chain in Salt Lake City is a smart economic move for Utah.
And another speaker at Friday's summit, a gentleman by the name of Richard Barkham, he's a London-based chief economist. He was singing the praises of this airport and the new airport out there and the reconstruction that's going on. Why is that so important to Utah's economy other than bringing more tourists in?
Yeah, well, I characterize it as the gift that keeps giving because it has all the benefits of the construction of a new facility. And those construction benefits, circulate throughout the economy. It's the largest public works project in our state's history. Now, importantly, Renee, it's being paid for without increasing our tax dollars. So they're paying for this with savings, with FAA grants, with gate fees from the airlines, and royalties from the rental car companies. And so we get this huge construction project without having to pay for it. That's a massive economic benefit to our state. More importantly, long-term, we have this wonderful facility that will not only serve our transportation needs, and do it in a high-quality way for tourists and business travelers, but also I think it ensures that Delta, for the foreseeable future, will have Salt Lake City as its western hub. And so that combination of things makes it a real jewel for our state.
Yeah, and keeping this as a hub for Delta is important. One of the things I've noticed as a business traveler is there are fewer direct flights to where I want to go today than there were 6 or 7 years ago, and that makes it much more difficult for me to do my job. In particular, Southwest Airlines has many fewer flights. They went into Denver, and most of their direct flights out west now, or many of them have been transferred over. So that's been, frankly, a burden for all business travelers that are based here or trying to get here. What about the prison? I used to live down in Draper, and that was obviously very controversial. It took over a decade to make this happen, but it's taking place. What's the vision for that space, and how do we use that land to maximize economic growth here in Utah?
Right. Well, the way I presented at the summit is I made the point that there's really nowhere in this country where two large and growing metropolitan areas are merging, and at the center of that merger are 20,000 acres of buildable land, and right in the center of those 20,000 acres is 700 acres of state-owned land, that's the prison site, once the prison is moved, that can serve as a catalyst for that economic vision. So the state, I think I join other community leaders in saying that this is our opportunity to do something for people, 20, 50, 60 years from now, because if we do it right, we'll put something there that catalyzes a lot of new economic activity. And what everybody's looking at is the universities and how the universities, whether it's Utah Valley University, Salt Lake Community College, BYU, the University of Utah, can come together and have a vision for providing a workforce and research that can fuel the tech sector that is located there. So it's an extraordinary opportunity for our state. We have not made the decision of what we're doing, but they're actively studying it and I think doing a nice job.
Well, let's talk about something that could happen, maybe likely happen, about 12 years from now, a 2030 Winter Games year. You were the governor's media spokesperson for the 2002 Olympics. You saw firsthand how the Olympics helped Utah's economy. How can Utah make it even better the next go-around?
Well, I think the thing that is so wonderful about our state and about our Olympic legacy is that it's living, that it continues to this day, and that so much was put into taking the surplus or profits from the games and investing them in Utah as a winter sports capital. And I get, highly motivated by that. I was really happy to see this legislative session that the Utah legislature put ongoing funding on the table to help invest in these facilities. So I don't know the numbers exactly, but they gave a one-time appropriation to the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation and then have an ongoing appropriation to help with these. And it doesn't go directly to the foundation. It goes to an entity that can grant this money, but the people that will receive those grants will be these Olympic facilities. So we have just, it is another, Renee, example of a state that sees around corners, looks to the future, invests, and we're taking this prosperity and trying to do things that can help us down the road.
And the Olympics could mean a big infusion of federal tax money. How do you see that helping our transportation infrastructure? That's a big deal up here in Park City when we talk about traffic and the cars coming in for the resorts. Do you think a 2030 Olympics could provide some relief?
You know, I think it's a little early for me to opine on that just because, I think until you have leadership in place and you really know that you are the U.S. bid city and then ultimately the IOC selection, I think that a lot has to come in place before that's assured. But let's be clear, for the 2002 Games, there was extraordinary investment made in our state, and it wasn't for the Olympics. You know, we didn't like build light rail for the Olympics or redo I-15 in Salt Lake County for the Olympics. But we got our act together as a community. We knew the spotlight was going to be really bright. We went back and asked for these funds. After 9/11 and some of these security issues hit, we asked for more funds, and it ended up being quite a substantial investment in our state. I don't think it was so much the federal money as it was the fact that we came together on a unified vision for our state and acted on it.
Great. Let's go back to the summit that was recently held. Herbert not only gave the keynote address there, but on Friday, he also signed a number of bills into law. SB 131 developed a new office within the Governor's Office of Economic Development, Talent Ready kind of focus there. SB 103 kind of strengthens the partnership between the legislature and technical colleges. I've got two more to go through. SB 104 incentivize students to pursue technical degrees. It forgives some of their educational loans. And HB 437 sets up scholarships to encourage kids to pursue certain educational degrees. Which of those are you most excited about? Which one or two would you say, you know what, this is going to make a difference for us?
Well, I attended that bill signing just because it was right at the summit, and I went in the room and watched as several legislators and the governor stood there. The top person for Silicon Slopes was there for it. I think the part that stands out for me is the connection between our economy and the technical degrees and the way that we're making that a priority. You know, if you look at job growth in our state, the fastest growing industry right now is construction, and that requires a lot of trades to make that happen. This is partly because of the airport, but it's also because we do have a housing shortage in our state. We need to build more homes. We are creating more households than we are housing units, and that's a problem, and so we have to get after that. Even the manufacturing sector in our state is growing at 3.2%. The manufacturing sector requires people with technical training. And so I'm very enthusiastic about the vision there. Senator Ann Milner, who was president of Weber State University, was the main sponsor for several of these bills, and she's someone who understands the connection between higher ed and the economy.
Great. And one of the other things Herbert mentioned in his keynote was the coming trade potential for a trade war and the damage that that causes. You're an economist, obviously a traditionally trained economist. Tariffs are a bad, bad thing. I think China has been pretty strategic in how they've struck back. They seem to be going after regions that are going to hurt congressional districts that are up for grabs in a attempt to maybe sway the outcome of elections and change things. What's your thoughts? How much at risk is Utah on what you're seeing, at least currently, in the trade wars?
Yeah. Doug, I think it's a great question. And I will say that Governor Herbert's speech at the summit was, I think, among his most significant policy speeches I have heard him deliver. It was very focused on globalization and the benefits of trade to our state. And he takes a very strong position, a hardliner position, if you will, on how we need open markets for Utah exports. So it was a strong statement that he made, and I really agree with his points. I don't think that there's anything that has lifted living standards in our world more than open markets. Utah punches greater than its weight in exports, and it's everything from transportation equipment to chemicals to a lot of primary metals, a lot of information technology or computers and electronics, and we need markets for this. And the notion of a trade war just serves no purpose in my mind for the United States and for Utah, and our governor made that point at the summit. That was his focus of the speech.
Natalie, you're going to be one of the keynote speakers at the upcoming Wasatch-backed Economic Summit. That's May 15th at the Zermatt Resort, where key issues facing Summit and Wasatch counties will be addressed. And I read a comment on a news article recently about Utah's rural economic success is often seen as a them or us proposition. Country versus city, rancher versus environmentalist, old-timer versus newcomer, tourism versus agriculture. Man, if we see that anywhere, it's here in Summit and Wasatch counties. What hope is there for the person who's been here for generations, who has a ranch, who wonders if the next generation can continue?
Yeah, you are at ground zero for a lot of that. I can see that. You know, so just to give you a couple of stats that are interesting, if you look at population growth in the country, the number one, you know, the fastest growing metropolitan area in the country was St. George last year. And the fastest growing micropolitan area in the country was Heber City last year. And then three of the top 10 fastest growing counties in the nation were in Utah last year. So these growth pressures on the in rural and on the sort of urban ring are really among the most intense in the nation, and you guys are right in the center of it. You know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about what we call Utah's silent recession, and that is that we're in these prosperous times, but we have right now 8 rural counties that are actually contracting. They're getting smaller each year, and that's a problem. And, you know, we have to, as a state, help these communities. And so, you know, I don't know the answer, Renee, but I do know that the endless fighting and, you know, tossing of bombs at each other doesn't work. And I think the best thing you can do is have a collective vision and work towards it. I give super high marks to Summit County for what it's done in critical land conservation over the years. You know, you've set such a high standard for the state, and I think that's a positive step. I also think that there's a bunch of, you know, realism that needs to enter the equation, and that there is an economy that has passed in many parts of our state, and it has to change and diversify. And so I think you need to put some good minds together to solve this. This is a problem in our state, and, of course, you feel the pressures more than in most areas.
Well, let's stay on this topic of kind of the dichotomy. There's areas that are doing really well, and then there's areas or places or people that are feeling challenges. And on that theme, you know, as I was talking about the new bills that Governor Herbert signed, a lot of that was to encourage young people to get into these fields where there are going to be opportunities in the future. You know, one of the things I see with my friends, I'm in my mid-50s, and I do have some friends that are towards the end of their career, and they were hoping to work another decade, but they found that maybe their skills, they haven't kept up with them as well as they should, and they're facing challenges in today's economy. What do you think we should be doing to get our mature workers the skill set that they need to continue to thrive until they decide to retire?
Well, you do have to set the expectation both for yourself personally, but in the government training programs, that we live in a world of continuous education and continuous learning. And there are, you know, there's a list of things that we could be doing to help rural Utah's economy. And, you know, most of those things deal with diversification and retraining and talent supply. And so, you know, so for example, it would be great to see computer coding camps, more prevalent in rural Utah, because there's a workforce there and coding can be done remotely, and you can, you know, have your part-time job doing some agricultural things and also some steady income through tapping into the tech sector. There's lots of ideas to put coding training in rural Utah high schools. So that's just one of many ideas that I've seen floated around, and I think that it's clear that the governor's made this a priority. He's mentioned in his last several state addresses, and has an initiative to deal with this.
And Natalie, from IT to tourism, you know, we're a large tourism-based economy up here in Park City. We know that tourism brings in a lot of money to our state with the Great Five national parks, with the ski industry. Do you see tourism growing exponentially as far as its importance in the state's economy, or will it always stay status quo?
I think that tourism is a big part of Utah's future. We have so much to offer there. And, you know, right now it is, I said, construction's our fastest growing industry right behind it, and almost the same is the leisure and hospitality industry. So I think that's huge. But I would point to a couple other things that might be helpful in this. You know, you do have some state policies that can change. We have a fund in the state. It's the Community Impact Board fund that helps fund, that comes from energy development that can be reinvested in energy economies. But right now we prohibit that money being used for economic development. And I think we need to change that. I think we can have an economic development infrastructure fund in our state where we could go invest in, let's say, really important tourism infrastructure investments that will maintain the quality of our tourism sector in the state. I think that the governor could be doing domestic trade missions where he takes business leaders off the Wasatch Front and goes into some of these rural counties and tries to find where are their connections between the urban economy and the rural economy. We go on foreign trade missions. I think we should be doing in-state trade missions. And there's even some ideas about a rural Utah Job Corps where you could, I'm just going to pick an example, but say to someone, we'll pay your tuition for this occupation. If when you finish, you go apply that craft in rural Utah. So those are just some of the ideas being bounced around. These are certainly things, when you're a prosperous state like we are, there are things we can do.
Natalie Gochner, thank you so much for being on the show with us this morning. And our listeners, if you like what you heard there from Natalie and you've got more questions, just a reminder, you can hear her again May 15th at the Wasatch Back Economic Summit. That's at the Zermatt Resort. Natalie, thanks for being with us this morning.
Doug and Renee, my pleasure. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. Mountain Money will be right back. We'll be talking to Mark Nold about a new study that highlights high-wage jobs in Utah. That's coming up right after this.
Hi, I'm Tony Tyler with Columbus Pacific Development. We're a proud sponsor of Mountain Money programming on KPCW. Columbus Pacific Development is a local Park City company with offices in Canyons Village. We're dedicated to bringing residential, hospitality, and commercial projects to Park City, including the Kimball on Main, Apex, and Viridian Residences.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design, love your home.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Another thank you to Natalie Gochner, Associate Dean at the David Eccles School of Business at the University of Utah. We're going to stick on the theme of Utah's economy. On the phone with us now, we have Mark Nold. He is the supervising economist and lead researcher of a recent study on Utah's core IT sector. Mark, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
My pleasure.
So let's start off with just an overview. What was the goal of the research project that you led?
Well, we wanted to take a look at the IT industry in particular in Utah and really get to the heart and soul of it, the foundation, which is the coding occupations within the IT industry, because after all, the coders are the ones who produce the product. They're the ones who bring it to life. They're the ones who make a product that then the salespeople sell and so on. So we wanted to get a feel for the coding industry and those occupations. Now, we've had dialogue with the people who understand and work within the IT industry in Utah, and they're always talking about we could use more labor, we could use more workers, we could use more workers. But yet, when we evaluate the industry, we see oftentimes 2 to 3 times the average job growth in that area than we do at the state overall. And so we're sitting here. I'm not saying that they couldn't use more labor. It's just interesting that if they could find all the labor they want, could the growth rates be even more and be even higher? But what we wanted to really evaluate was how much does in-migration contribute to the labor force in the core IT industries? And so we just started looking at in-migration, and of course the study kind of got bigger from there. Well, that naturally led to what about out-migration? And then if where ultimately does all the labor come from that does, you know, contribute to the Utah core IT industry? Is it in migration? Is it internal education that provides it and so on? So that was really the gist of what we why we did this study. We wanted to initially look at in migration, but it ultimately turned out, well, let's just look at and profile the labor in that area and where it comes from.
Okay. And Mark, first explain to our listeners what in-migration is and out-migration is and why it was so important that you wanted to launch this study to understand it better.
Well, again, it's the IT industry is always asking for a lot of labor, and there's a lot of pressure that can be put on the legislature to increase education programs to feed that industry. But also when you looked at other areas like Denver and Boulder, you go back to 20, 25 years ago, and they grew an initial IT industry out. A lot of their labor came from in-migration. So I just wanted to get a feel for the in-migration aspect here in Utah and how much it contributed to it. So we have the state, all states have an unemployment insurance program. So within that, all the employers in the state report on a quarterly basis, all of their employees. So with that, we can track workers. And so we would find workers that were brand new into the industry here in the state of Utah. And then we would look back through the records to see, did they come from another industry in Utah itself, or were they nowhere in the Utah employment records? And if they weren't, we made the assumption that they were a new in-migrant coming in. Conversely, on the other end, if we see people in the industry and then going forward with the records, we don't see them in any Utah industry anymore, we would make the assumption then that they were out migrants.
So just to be clear, you work with Utah Workforce Services. You're with the Research and Analysis Division, and you guys are the ones who did this study.
That is correct.
And so with more than 90% of the core IT new hires coming from other industries within Utah, is there one industry in particular you are seeing them come from?
No, they come across the entire spectrum of industries because, after all, we looked at what we would call core IT industries. In other words, we here are industries that we can identify that hire a lot of coding workers and coding IT workers. Now, coding IT workers can be found across all industries. They can be in government. They can be in the banking industry. They can be supporting retail trade industries and so on. But our records do not identify people down to an occupational level. So I can't look at the government industry and find the coders in there and say, oh, look, that person left coding in government and jumped over here into this core IT industry. All we can do is just see that they were in another Utah industry, and then at some point in time, they moved over here into the core IT industry. And your point was that ultimately what we did discover was that the in-migration wasn't that big of a component in terms of supplying labor to the core IT industry. You made mention of 90%, and that's what we were discovering was when we did look at the new hires into this industry, 90% or more of them were coming from other industries within the state of Utah, and therefore, by extension, we make the assumption that most of those people are getting their education and training here within the Utah education system.
Okay, and let's talk about some of those places where people get educated. In case listeners are interested, they're doing a job now. They see the growth in IT. They hear our previous speaker talk about, you know, what kind of great opportunities there are in the future. What are the main sources there? And we've heard a lot about, and we've had guests on that are from code camps. Is that playing a big role, or do folks need to really go back to the university and get a 2-year or 4-year degree to do this?
Both of those paths will work. What we're seeing here in Utah, when we evaluated the core IT industry, we could go to some Census Bureau records that would does surveying of the economy throughout the whole United States, and we did look at this core IT industry and looked at the people and saw their education levels. And in the end, what here in the state of Utah, it's a very balanced education background that we find in this industry. And when I say education background, I'm talking either the technical trainings or the vocational trainings or even some kind of certifications, all the way up to the bachelor's degree or higher level. So it's about a 50-50 mix, which means there's opportunities either way to get into the Utah IT industry. When you look at it at a national level and evaluate the IT industry, almost 70% of the people working in the industry at the national level have a bachelor's degree or higher. But here in Utah, it's more of a 50-50 mix. So obviously there's a lot of opportunities for people to, they don't have to go all the way back to the university level to get their foot into this industry. Just a little retraining in the vocational areas or maybe, again, some of these boot camps and so on can really fill in that respect.
So what is the pay for a coding worker? What could you expect to earn entry level?
Oh, good question. Here's the nice thing about this industry is that here in the state of Utah, it's a high-paying industry. So you get to the median pay in these coding areas, and they can approach $80,000 to $90,000 a year. And again, this is our areas where you could do this with and get those kind of pay areas without having to go and get the four-year college degree. So when you go back through the history of Utah and you look at the old Kennecotts and the old Geneva Steels that were there, you know, these were areas where someone could come out of high school, get a job there, and make a lot of money, you know, good high middle income earnings. And this was in the natural resource industries and so on. And we've seen those fade and move off to smaller and lesser parts of the Utah economy. So what parts of the service economy are available to fill that void? Where can you get less than the high education training and make this kind of money? And fortunately, the IT area is one of the prime areas to do that, where you can get these high earnings here within the state of Utah without having to work all the way to the bachelor's degree or higher level in your education.
Mark, I like the fact you brought up Kennecott as an example. It used to be, you know, people could graduate high school, apply there. Maybe they knew somebody. It was a hard job to get, but if you got it, you know, you were kind of set for life. And those folks had high-wage jobs, but they're kind of stuck at that firm. One of the nice things about the coding industry is you see these young people move around from company to company, location to location, and it gives them a lot of flexibility. What are you seeing there? Being in the Department of Workforce Services, you probably see the average tenure of folks. Is my anecdotal observation correct? Is it much more mobile, these employees, or do they tend to stick around for 10 years at one job?
Good points. It's not the anchoring the way it used to be, as you said, like in the Kennecott areas where there was another copper mine that you could jump around to and so on. In the IT industry, yes, it's a young labor force that generally supports that. They have their mobility is as part of this, it's much more mobility available to them. And the fact that it is young oftentimes means that you're will make those moves to try and, so to speak, move up the ladder. You're not at the point where you've climbed a ladder and you've found a nice niche and gotten into that career, and I'm real comfortable where it's at. So just the fact that it's a youthful labor force means that it can be a much more mobile labor force. That isn't to say there aren't those who have not, you know, there are those who have attained their niche, who are comfortable where they're at and may stick it out for a long period of time. But generally, the industry is characterized with a lot of mobility, and a lot of that has to go with just the youthfulness of the labor force that supports that industry.
So, Mark, we know they are young. What about other demographic breakdowns, male versus female?
It's largely a heavy male-dominated area. It's about 70% seems to be males that work in the industry, you know, and then 30% of the female activities on the other end.
Why is that, do you think?
Good question. Sometimes it may just boil down to aptitudes and so on. I know I've always kind of made comments like, used to be when I was growing up, the people who tinkered were, you know, working on cars and always, you know, the mechanics of the cars and so on. And now the cars are, you know, have computers in them, and that's hard to do. So where does the tinkering mind go now in that respect, and oftentimes they find a nice niche within the IT industry. And what I mean by that is people can get very proficient in coding and IT activities without having a formal education. It's just an aptitude, just some kind of a tinkering mechanism or activity that's in their nature and so on. And I don't know if that explains the male-female breakdown in it, but again, we do see that it is a much more male-dominated industry.
Where does the tinkering mind go? I like that. That's a good note for us to close on. Our guest this morning has been Mark Nold. He's the supervising economist and lead researcher on a recent study on Utah's core IT sector. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And stay tuned to Mountain Money. Up next, we'll be speaking with Liz Garcia-Levitt. She is the clinical social worker and health educator at the University of Utah. She's going to talk to us about transitioning through different phases of life. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
A longtime supporter of KPCW, Jan's Mountain Outfitters sells and rents mountain bikes and road bikes. Our bike shop provides bike fitting, parts, tunes, and repair service. Jan's Fly Shop is stocked with fishing gear and offers guided fishing excursions and lessons, serving Park City for over 30 years. 649-4949 or jans.com.
Hi, this is Greg Cropper of Jones Waldo Park City, a Park City law office. I've been a big fan of KPCW since its first broadcast back in 1980. Jones Waldo has been representing clients from Summit and Wasatch counties since 1875. You can find us at joneswaldo.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our next guest is Liz Garcia-Levitt, clinical social worker and health educator at the University of Utah Center for Alzheimer's Care and Research. Liz, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So you're going to be at the free lunch and learn next Monday at the Snyderville Basin Recreation Fieldhouse, and it's part of May being Mental Health Awareness Month. You're going to talk about the natural transitions from working full-time to retirement to maybe going from independent living to managed care. How do we handle those discussions with our spouse? How do we handle those discussions with our parents? That's a lot to tackle in one lunch and learn.
It is a lot, but I think a lot. Often the key is planning for different possibilities and really talking about ahead of time what our goals and making sure our life and our finances and our planning really line up with what we want to have happen as time goes on as we age.
And what are some of the key points in this? I consider myself to be a student of good decision making, and I think in any of these transitions, whether you're thinking about whether it's time to retire or is it time to sell your house because maybe you're getting a little bit older and keeping the house up is more challenging, or is it time to move into an assisted living center. How do people, those are really daunting questions. How do people make good decisions?
You know, I think oftentimes it's realizing that a crisis can happen to anybody at any time. And, you know, I think oftentimes we plan for the best, but don't necessarily plan for the worst case scenario when we're putting things together. And healthy aging is a big key. You know, often people are in a really great routine when they're working, but when they start moving into retirement, sometimes they let some of that routine fall away. You know, in Park City, it's a big issue because often people are buying, you know, these retirement homes with the idea of that's going to be their forever home. But many of the homes up in Park City aren't necessarily built if somebody has some kind of a movement issue or aren't unable to manage stairs or snow as well. And so often it's not what people are thinking of when they're first retiring, that they may be in a different situation 10 years from now and have to make another change.
It's difficult for a younger person who, and by younger I mean middle-aged, who needs to have that conversation with their parents about moving on to managed care or perhaps saying to your parents, you know, I just don't think you're as on top of it as you have been in the past. How do you approach your parent with that conversation?
You know, often it's not a one-time conversation, and I think that's the key. It's, you know, having little, smaller conversations along the way. And also I think most of the time kids don't always think of that there may be multiple options often, you know, if a senior just maybe needs a little bit of help with, you know, managing medications or meals, you can bring in aides or assistants into the home for a lot cheaper than making a big jump to an assisted living if people want to stay in their own home. And it's often sitting down and thinking, you know, what are the real deficits or the real challenges that this person's having? And are there ways to kind of piecemeal meet that need for a while? Because often assisted livings are the most expensive option. And they're, often people can get away with quite a while some lower levels of care or less invasive options. We always want to try to encourage people to be in the least restrictive environment, but also helping them stay as independent as possible where they want to live as long as they can.
Liz, let me build on Renee's question. You know, having this conversation when you're in middle age, and I think getting back to my point on making good decisions, I think to the extent it's an ongoing conversation, it's not taboo. I think the results are likely to be more successful for everybody. Oftentimes people are reluctant to talk about this in part because, you know, it's talking about their own mortality. It's talking about their own declining health, which is a difficult thing. Are there some tools that you found that have made it easier to begin this conversation, to bring it up? Is there a good book? Is there a good online resource that people can use and say, hey, mom and dad, look at this, and then let's have a conversation?
Probably for general planning, one of my favorite resources is actually the Association for Retired Persons, ARP website. They actually have some really wonderful tools on it that talk about, you know, different what-ifs and how to have the conversation. You know, and there are financial planning resources that people could really benefit from going through, but also medical planning information. I always recommend for all of our patients to maybe sit down with an attorney at some point to really go through your specific situation and talk about, you know, making sure you have all the paperwork in place. And that can often be a good way for parents and kids to sit down maybe with a legal representative to make sure all the, you know, T's are crossed and I's are dotted to, you know, make sure if there is a crisis that everything's kind of in the same place. It's often also an easier way to kind of, you know, something everybody should do, but to bring some of the adult children into the conversation so that they have an idea of what the situation is with their parents.
So, Liz, I heard a futurist recently say that we should be prepared to live well past 100, which struck me as somewhat odd and optimistic.
Yeah.
How is aging changing that you've seen?
You know, what I've seen is often, you know, I think about, you know, my own life, I never met any of my great-grandparents, and then my children have met four or five of their great-grandparents. You know, people are living longer. The things that we used to die of in our 50s and 60s, the heart diseases and the cancers, are not going away, but people are surviving them into their 60s and 70s and 80s more. So we've turned a lot of our medical conditions into chronic conditions, and often it does leave people more disabled than they were before that condition, but they're surviving. They're not necessarily surviving healthier, though. And so that's something that I've seen in the last, 15-odd years that I've been doing this, is people making it into their 80s and 90s, more like where they may have died in their 50s and 60s previously, but not necessarily being healthier.
Great. Well, let's talk about that, because we are living longer. You know, I'm fortunate my mother's 84 years old. She's actually relatively healthy for 84. But it's a challenge for her because, unfortunately, a lot of her friends have passed away. And so she does feel isolated. She's fortunate in that she lives with my sister, and so she has that family, her family around also. But how does a person, as they get older, as some of their friends pass away, how do they develop bring these new things in so that they have this healthy routine that you talked about earlier?
You know, it is really a conscious effort. It's easy to stop doing activities as we get older and not necessarily pick up new ones. And what I tend to find is people that are more successful with aging, have a healthier aging pattern, tend to constantly be learning new things and making new friends, having a full calendar of things that they're passionate about. And I think that's a really big key, is to have things that you're constantly interested in and engaged with. Service is a wonderful thing, and that need doesn't really go away, the need to give back and to help others. But sometimes it's a matter of adapting and changing a little bit the way you do things. And those that can kind of make that shift to doing, finding new activities that they're enjoying as time goes on, they tend to be a lot happier and a lot healthier.
Liz, we've got about a minute left, but a big conversation in the Park City community these days is how to have a complete community and how to make space for seniors in our community. How do you do that other than say, we've got a senior center?
Well, I think part of it is looking at housing options. It's a big issue up in Park City that there aren't, you know, assisted livings, or there aren't really walkable apartments close to a lot of services. And so part of it is looking at community planning and having that place if people do need to downsize and want to stay in the community. And also, you know, and that has to come from demand from within, I think. Also, you know, looking at using our seniors and having volunteer opportunities for them within our community. Often they're a wonderful untapped resource that can be really helpful in community building.
Well, Liz, we thank you for joining us. Our guest this morning has been Liz Garcia-Levitt. She is a clinical social worker and health educator at the University of Utah Center for Alzheimer Care and Research. And you can hear Liz this coming Monday, so a week from today. There's a free lunch at the Snyderville Basin Fieldhouse on Monday, May 7th. Liz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Mountain Money. Stay tuned for a few minutes, and Renee and I will wrap up today's show.
Being a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business and provides a wide array of benefits. We promote your business, provide networking and educational opportunities, and even have benefit programs for you and your employees. For more information, visit us online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Special thanks to our guests this morning, but also to our great sponsors. We couldn't do a show like Mountain Money without the support of our sponsors, and they include Mountain West Bank, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Development with Viridian and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
And a big thank you to our guests this morning, Natalie Gochner, Associate Dean at the David Eccles School of Business down at the University of Utah, economist Mark Nold, he's with the Utah Department of Workforce Services, and Liz Garcia-Levitt, she's a clinical social worker and health educator at the University of Utah as well. Thanks to all of those guests. It's been an interesting morning, Doug.
It has been, and it's been an interesting week. You know, we were talking during break about the North Korea and South Korea coming together for the meeting there. Renee, you were asking our first guest about the economic impact of Olympics, and I actually think that the Olympics that we recently had there began to thaw things, and there was a very positive outcome from that.
It was interesting. I was reading a lot about that this weekend, just about North Korea's incentive to come to the table with South Korea, and was it the implosion of this mountainous nuclear power plant that perhaps forced the hand, or is there more strategy involved? It's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch.
There's some big issues going on in the world right now, and it would be huge if we could take that risk off the table, and hopefully we can take the fear of a trade war off the table here sometime soon as well.
And something else we're going to be looking at this week, Doug, of course, is what the Feds do in regards to interest rates. I think they're going to make a decision. Is it Wednesday?
We'll find out about it Wednesday, yeah. Probably a quarter point increase in interest rates.
Great. Well, that's been Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley-Miller with Doug Wells. Thanks for listening. You're listening to KPCW Park City.